Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe in association with the Center for Finance, Law, and Policy at Boston University and the Czech and Slovak Association of Boston. Our speakers are Peter Gondalovich, Czech Ambassador to the U.S., and Peter Kmeč, Slovak Ambassador to the U.S. Our moderator is Alan Berger, retired editorial writer for international affairs at the Boston Globe. We begin with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe Director Vivian Schmidt.
Peter Gondalovich has been ambassador of the Czech Republic since 2011, a graduate of Charles University in Prague. He was one of the founding members of the Civic Democratic Party. From 1992 to 1994, he served as Deputy Minister of the Environment. From 1994 to 1997, he was Senior Director and Advisor to the Minister for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. From 1997 to 2002, he was General Consul of the Czech Republic in New York. He then served as Mayor of the city of Ústí nad Labem. He was Minister of Regional Development and finally Minister of Agriculture from 2007 to 2009. Peter Kmeč has been ambassador of Slovakia since September 2012. He earned a graduate degree in international relations at the Moscow State Institute of International Relations in 1990 and a degree in international law and legal studies at Comenius University in Bratislava the same year. He later worked for the Federal Czechoslovak Foreign Ministry and Slovak Foreign Ministry. Between 2000 and 2003, he was deputy ambassador in Israel. Between 2003 and 2005, held the same post in the USA. Later, he worked as head of the Office of the Foreign Minister and as a Slovak ambassador to Sweden. As most of you know, 2013 marks 24 years since the Velvet Revolution that put an end to communist rule in Czechoslovakia, and 20 years since the Velvet Divorce, or the breakup of Czechoslovakia into two independent states. The ambassadors will be discussing subsequent developments in their countries, in particular, since joining the EU. Questions to be pursued include what the EU is becoming, how its policies and institutions are evolving, how its role as international actor is enhanced or not in response to new global challenges, and why, under conditions of globalization, its relationship with the United States remains more important than ever. I would also like insights into your views of the Eurozone crisis as well. The conversation will be moderated by Alan Berger, retired editorial writer on international affairs at the Boston Globe. Alan graduated from Harvard in history and literature, took an MA in comparative literature from Cornell, taught at MIT in the humanities department, and served as the Boston Globe's editorial writer on international affairs until retiring in 2011. Thank you. So, Alan, it's over to you.
Well, each of the ambassadors will make a statement, and then we'll have a question and answer period. So would you like to begin?
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you at such a prestigious university. I understand that this program is actually being paid for by the EU, so we decided to at least try to be positive about the EU. And then finally, we actually designated roles that Peter will be the good cop and I'll be the bad cop. And I'll try to be brief so that there will be some more room for the questions. I prepared actually four statements or maybe provocative issues to provoke your questions. First, theory. The euro is not the cause of the crisis. Maybe quite a surprising one, but I think that is true because I'm convinced that it is the unsound policies of individual states that are actually the cause of the euro crisis. We, as you know, differ. We've been together until 1993, and the character of economic transformation has been or had been very similar until the separation, obviously, and eventually the two economies went its own way, so the Czechs do not use the euro, Slovaks use the euro, and so you can see some of the similarities and differences. For instance, Slovakia, as a country that uses euro, has actually weathered the economic crisis much better than the Czech Republic. As a matter of fact, you have growth over 2%, while the Czech Republic is still struggling around zero, and we'll be happy if there will be 1% growth in 2013. So the theory that the euro is not the cause of the crisis, but it is the policies of individual states. I think the Slovakia, as a country that uses euro, didn't experience such a crisis as, for instance, Greece, which has unemployment over 25% and a drop in GDP of more than 7%. We may argue that euro actually covers the symptoms of a disease. It was the case in Greece, where Greeks were able to borrow at a very favorable rate until it was clear that they were not going to be able to repay it. And also, euro obviously makes it more difficult to cure the disease, because a country that gets itself in a crisis cannot devaluate, cannot make its central bank to buy its own bonds, buy its own debt. Obviously, as a result of that, the Czechs may not be very much willing to adopt the euro in any foreseeable future. We keep our koruna. And some people actually enjoy that the koruna is a stable and strong currency, while other people obviously complain that it is too strong and makes exports too difficult. Secondly, the Czech Republic, as I said, has been not doing so well in the recent 1.5 years, 6 quarters. And we may serve as an example of the dilemma between austerity policies versus growth stimulus. In the Czech Republic, the center-right government declared as its goal, as its objective, to squeeze the debt or the deficit under 3% of the GDP. This effort actually was a very painful exercise that needed government investments to be decreased by more than 12%, and actually resulted in a very significant drop in domestic demand. The Czech Republic, being a export-oriented country, still is doing very well, or relatively fairly well, in the export. So while domestic demand takes away at least 2% of the GDP growth, the exports fix it to be around zero. Of course, the discussion whether austerity or stimulus has been around very as an intense debate recently. I think it needs some time to be decided, because these policies may have a rather adverse effect in the short term, but may actually become a good grounds for future growth in some future. Maybe we can take Latvia as one of the examples that after a very significant drop in demand in GDP, they've been actually picking up very well recently. The third theory, I think it's a rather a statement. Of course, the EU is now a practically two-speed organization. Obviously, the European Union as such, with 28 members and 17 Eurozone, 17 members of the Eurozone. Unfortunately, the dealing with the euro crisis has been dominating all the political discussion within the European Union. So there is this effect that European Union has been sort of abandoning many of its important reforms and policies while being over-consumed with this debate about the future of the Eurozone and consequently about institutional arrangements or institutional reforms that the Eurozone crisis has actually has brought as necessity. So while here in America you deal with the purely economic crisis, maybe to some extent I'm not supposed to comment on that, but let's say a little bit of misunderstanding in Washington. In Europe, we deal with actually a substantial problem of institutional reform of its very architecture. And of course, this simple equation that the monetary union needs a fiscal union, that needs a political union, works well or sounds easy, but is easier said than done, because obviously the fiscal union would actually need the Brussels to be responsible for much bigger portion of the European GDP than it is now, because it's just around 1%. Such a fiscal union that's now being discussed in the form of the fiscal compact and perhaps in the banking side, the banking union itself would need a much stronger political and democratic oversight, which is obviously not going to happen, because this is surely not the case with the European Parliament, and this is not going to be soon happening that the political union would actually work as you know it here in America, that nations would not, or the voters would not regard nationality of a politician to vote for, but the political agenda that would actually be the reason why I vote for this or that politician across the entire Europe. This is not going to happen in any foreseeable future, because the nation state is and will be for many, many years to the future the foundation of our democracy. So the third point I'm leaving open, because I do not want to sound too critical, too pessimistic, but on the other hand, I do not have any answer to that dilemma. Maybe the fourth and final remark, I might end on a more optimistic note. I think we have to take into account that the EU has been or was built on those four freedoms of movement, the movement of people, money, capital and services. This is actually an unfinished job. And as I said, unfortunately, recently the euro crisis has overshadowed these efforts. We stress that there is a lot to do in these reforms or measures to be put in place. For instance, the free movement of services is not ideal. It is hindered by many, many regulations where protectionism is actually disguised behind all sorts of hygienic or quality of labor conditions criteria or certificates. So in practice, it is very difficult to move services across Europe freely. It's much easier with money. Capital is now being I would say a little reversed recently in connection with the banking crisis in several countries. So What we say is that there is a lot of work to do to strengthen and deepen all these four fundamental freedoms on which the European Union should stand and is supposed to be its core purpose. Recently, as you know, President Obama declared as his priority to push the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and I see it as not only a chance for both continents on both sides of the Atlantic to boost our bilateral trade, but also a chance to get rid of many of the unnecessary regulation in Europe, because while we will be actually debating about converging our regulatory systems, we may even as well come to the idea that we might just get rid of some of those regulations, some of those certificates, some of those stamps to be necessary for doing business. So this is my optimistic ending, that we on both sides of the Atlantic may find our way of the crisis with going forward with the talks about our transatlantic trade and investment partnership. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good evening. First of all, let me thank Professor Schmidt, the Center for Study of Europe, for organizing this this discussion. We appreciate it very much with my Czech colleague. Also, I'm honored to sit next to Mr. Berger of Boston Globe, from whom I should expect tough questions, of course, because, you know, there is a lot of questions about Europe, European Union, the situation, but this is why we have this discussion, and it's very important also to listen from the U.S. audience how you see the situation from the other side of the Atlantic. So we are looking very much forward to your questions as well. I would like to bring you the perspective from three angles. First, I would like to give you some Slovak specifics, how we see the situation from within on the European, transatlantic, and global perspective. Then I would like to comment a little bit on European situation from within. And then we can look also at some EU challenges from the perspective of global affairs. When it comes to the first point, as you know, and as Peter mentioned, Czechoslovakia split in 1993, and we face different challenges. Alongside with other Central Europeans, we had three main tasks: to transform our societies from centralized economy into market economy. That was a huge task. Then we had the challenge of integrating ourselves to the European Union, to NATO, and other international bodies. Then suddenly it came the challenge of globalization, when the other Western Europeans and the rest of the world were preparing the strategies for joining the globalized markets. We had these two parallel challenges. And above all, Slovakia had the fourth great challenge. It was building the society from the scratch. So alongside with building the new society, democratic society, we had to build a political nation as such. Those processes actually left a lot of impact on every individual in Czech Republic and Slovakia. So Every Czech and Slovak has its own individual story to tell. Some Some stories are very positive, some stories are less positive. So the situation is really different. The societies are really heterogeneous compared to, you know, this homogeneity of the society from the past. So we also face these challenges from the integration of the society as such. What happened in Slovakia in those 20 years? We expected that this would be the processes for two or more generations to come, but within 20 years we suddenly appeared to be full-fledged members of the European Union, NATO, OECD, and other international bodies. Slovakia went even deeper in the integration. We adopted euro in 2009. The economy has been showing very positive figures, sometimes reaching even two-digit numbers. Slovakia got nicknames like Tatra Tiger, Detroit of Europe, in the positive connotation at those times. But then in 2009, economic crisis hit the global and financial markets, and we felt it all. Some countries felt it much more negative impacts, some countries a little bit less. Slovakia was left somewhere in the middle, as geographically and also with the structure of economy, we belong to northern part of Europe rather than to the southern wing. So we were left with the developments rather that we could see in northern part of Europe. And as Peter mentioned, euro currency helped Slovakia very much to stabilize the economy in macroeconomic terms. So we profited from joining euro in 2009. That was actually the year of beginning of the crisis. So we were, I would say, the winners of integration into the eurozone. But this is not the end of stabilization, because the challenges are great, and now we are at the same footing as our Western European partners in the European Union, but also as the United States over the other side in the Atlantic. And that's the challenge of building the intelligent economies from the point of view of more R&D-intensive industries, more competitive from the point of view of attracting creation of the startups, more investors. And this is the challenge for the whole West world. And we have been lagging behind in these considerations because of those developments that we had to experience during the two decades. So we had to focus and to put all of our resources to these new challenges. Slovakia is in a good position that keeps a very strong manufacturing base, and it has also a potential to be built new technologies, especially in IT areas. And we all know that there'll be winners in the future who will be able to marry both bricks and clicks. And Slovakia belongs to the group of countries that can join the digital natives very soon. And we expect that with those introduction of new IT technologies into the current manufacturing base, we can build the new vision of our economy. The second point I would like to touch upon, and it will be an addition to what Peter said, That's the situation in the European Union. Current developments within the EU show positive developments in general terms, because in the second quarter of 2013, European Union and Eurozone ended the recession. The more than expected growth in largest economies like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom show that the trend could be upswing and positive in the coming future. That's very positive for Slovakia because 2/3 of its exports end in the European Union markets. So we expect also rather positive development for this year. We'll be reaching the growth of GDP up to 2%. Next year, it's expected that we will grow about 2%. But there are challenges, especially in the area of public finances. We have to bring still our public deficit below 3%. We hope that it will happen this financial year. And in the next financial year, we will go even deeper. Also, structural reforms are a challenge with the inflow of European funds. We are able to invest in more prospective parts of the economy. So we hope that in coming years, we'll avoid the situation in some countries of the European Union. What are the challenges for the European Union? Europe, as you know, keeps the dynamism when it invests also to its domestic development, but when it invests also in its neighborhood. So the EU enlargement is really very important part of functioning of the European institutions. Slovakia, alongside with other Central Europeans, is supporter of further enlargement into Western Balkans. We have a number of positive processes, even recent success stories like Croatia. We work now very hard on a success with Eastern Partnership in Vilnius Summit that is to be held in a month time. Of course, there is, as you can see, there is a pressure of Russia to persuade some of the countries of Eastern Partnership to join Customs Union. So we are trying to work very hard before the summit with those aspirant countries to sign the CFTAs, comprehensive free trade agreements, including association agreements and free liberalization visa regimes. And the second issue, it was mentioned, it's the economic and trade aspect, and we look very much forward to signing the TTIP very soon. That will be actually a new trendsetter in world trade, and we expect that this will also set principles and rules for other regions. The last point I would like to make is the regional cooperation. The regional dimension within the European Union is very important part because building coalitions and promoting interests of the region is very important part of the EU policies. You know that we try to build the Visegrad group agenda. It's a long-standing, sometimes painful process. We worked closely on integration processes before we joined EU and NATO. There was a certain period of time where Visegrad was not so visible on the international scene, but now we are coming back, and I think that the interests of all countries in the region, both from the economic, political, but also military areas coincide. So I think that we can see much more structured cooperation. In 2016, we'll be finishing our preparations for the EU battle groups. That's part of the EU common security umbrella. But the aspiration is to keep the battle group together for the years to come. And it will be also interesting year for Slovakia that will be holding the presidency in 2016. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you both. Let me begin by asking a couple of questions and then we'll take questions from the floor. Ambassador Chemetz, shortly after joining the Eurozone, Slovakia voted against, it was the only country in the EU, against bailout, which was aimed at Greece at the time. And then there was a government change immediately and voted for it. Of course, in these parts, we'd like to have something similar with the elimination of the people who almost drove us over the default cliff. But my question is, given that drama, today, is Slovakia more inclined to the notion of ever greater unification in the European Union? And if not, why not?
Thank you very much. Yes, you are right that those were very difficult times for decision-making in Slovakia. We became kind of tea partiers in the Eurozone, and it was a really tough decision because different argumentations during the ratification process on bailout to Greece were used, including whether we should bail out richer countries that got into fiscal troubles, while Slovakia has to meet its own requirements. And as you know, bailout counts against the debt of the country. So we had to save ourselves more in order to make the bailout. And at that time, we had four political parties coalition, and it was a really tough decision. One of the parties opted not to vote, so there was an immediate fall of the government with new elections. After the elections, the central left government came to power. That is, one has to say, more inclined to the core of the EU integration and supports much speedier political integration of the European Union. So currently we can say that Slovakia belongs to those who are promoting faster political integration of the European Union.
Thank you. We'll take questions now from you. And as I said before, please make the question a real question.
I have a question to the social security benefits. I find out that a few years ago, the benefits in Czech and Slovak Republic was about three times less than in other countries. Is there any development in it, and how the Czech and Slovak people could look at it? Because it looks like they are supporting the countries who don't have balanced budget. So I wonder if you can put some lights on it.
Well, I would say you cannot use the exchange rate to compare pensions country to country. You have to look at the ratio between living costs, and perhaps we could even use the average salary towards the average pension, which in the Czech Republic is slightly below 50% now. We would be happy if it was rather over 50%, but it's not possible. And this is why the previous government introduced a so-called second pillar of social security, which is actually some sort of an equivalent of 401k system. So you set aside some part of your social security payment into a private fund under the government supervision. This has been quite controversial because the Social Democratic Party as well as the Communists did not agree with the introduction of this system. And
to an addition, social benefits and the income in general is a controversial issue from the perspective of also of competitiveness and attractiveness of the economic environment. Immediately you increase the salaries and benefits to the less competitive level, the manufacturing base will weaken, and that's what our countries have been doing quite successfully to keeping the balance between the income and competitiveness for the investors. Of course, the purchase parity power of our population is not such as in Western Europe yet, but the tendency of the real growth of income is positive. Of course, taking away the economic crisis in recent years, but in two decades, I think that we have been catching up very successfully. We try to measure it within the European Union through the EU average. If you take Slovakia, Slovakia was joining European Union with 48% of EU average. Now it enjoys 74% of EU average. So the jump is really remarkable. We have to support it with better social situation of the population.
I do have a question. In the past century, Czechs and Slovaks witnessed roughly every 20 years major event, were it collapse of Austria Empire, or rise of Nazis, communists, Soviet invasion, and collapse of communism. It's been roughly 25 years since Velvet Revolution. So my question is, do you see any possibility for any event in a roughly next 20 years? Or do you think that both countries are now safe in Europe? Or is Europe danger? Or could you comment on this?
Well, it has to be emphasized that this is one of the biggest achievements of the European Union, that there hasn't been any war on European soil, of course, except the Balkans. So the answer is no. I hope that there won't be any more 48s and 68s. 98 was quite uneventful. 2008, I don't very much remember. So I don't think so. I hope not.
Yeah, just to add, no revolutions or invasions, please. So we need evolutionary developments now, and we need to stabilize from within. And we also have been sharing our own experiences to the others, in order to avoid the mistakes we did. But sometimes it's successful, like in Western Balkans, in Eastern Partnership, less successful in Southern neighborhood, in MENA countries. But I think that from the perspective of security and stability, we are on the safe side, I would say, with integration.
I forgot to await Lehman Brothers of this. Yeah. But it was not our... we didn't do it.
But there were some waves that washed that way.
Yeah. Yes.
As we in the United States move from sequester one, and I'm sure we're going to go to sequester two. I'm just back from Washington, and we're going to have significant cuts in military participation in NATO. I think it's inevitable, especially if we go to the next round of sequester. I wonder what you can tell us about what you think the effects would be on the zone and on EU if we have significant cuts.
Yeah, tough question, because we have had kind of sequester in military expenditures for some time, and we have been suffering with especially with the part of military budget when it comes to procurement and innovations. I think that the answer for this is deeper integration in the region. To pool and share within the Visegrad group countries. We have been working on that. The most perspective way of integrating our militaries goes through the cooperation of former Czechoslovakia. But that also happened in the north, that not all the Nordic countries started cooperating together at the same time. So I think that we might be setting an example in the region for that. So I think that in public finances, there might not be a kind of positive developments when it comes to military expenditures. European Union is also looking into pooling and sharing approaches, and I think that there will be a number of developments. The coming summit of the European Union will be devoted to common security foreign policy, where defense cooperation and defense industry will be part of the discussions of the leaders.
I just add that we've been trying to persuade the U.S. To stay in Europe, at least in some form, as we all are going to pull out of Afghanistan. We need to find a way of exercising together to keep the interoperability going so that we don't lose this capability to work together. And I think that there might be ways how to do it for less if we find more efficient ways how to pool and share our resources.
First off, thank you very much for coming to BU. We appreciate it a lot. And I would like to ask, you mentioned earlier the pressure that is coming out of Russia for Ukraine to join their economic union and not enter into further economic union with the EU. As countries that were formerly under the influence of Russia, what advice are you giving the other European Union members in how to counteract that strong Russian rhetoric?
Well, I wouldn't say we are giving anyone advices. We cooperate. We definitely support Ukraine to enter the agreement on deep and comprehensive free trade agreement. We cooperate through the Eastern Partnership program, that is a European Union program, with civil society. We support non-governmental organizations. So we think that these measures will eventually create an atmosphere in these countries that the public of these countries will make the right decisions on their own.
Our lesson learned from the EU integration is transform your economy, comply with EU standards, and European Union will embrace you because the political will is there. We just need to work together with our Eastern European partners to comply with criteria and work together.
As two countries who joined the EU as members relatively later on since it's been formed, I did want to ask you guys about further EU expansion and specifically the question of Turkey. Obviously, there are legitimate assets and strategic advantages to allowing them to enter in as a member, but also legitimate difficulties or even dangers. And it's a very polarized topic within members of the EU currently. So I just would love to hear your own opinions on if you would support that or be against it and why.
I am inclined to support Turkey's accession to the European Union. It's been the position of the Czech Republic, so I'm not in any conflict with that. But of course, as it always is, this statement is accompanied by all sorts of ifs and whens.
Yeah, the same position of the Slovak Republic. We support integration of Turkey into the European Union, providing that it complies with criteria that we had to do as well in the past. So definitely it will be rather long process still to come because the negotiations have been strained and delayed for in several phases. Now there is, after the recent EU European Commission's report on enlargement, there is a new impetus to speed up the integration, so technical negotiations can start. So now it depends on the political will on both sides.
Yes.
So I believe Slovakia tried an experiment in economics with a flat tax, and I'm wondering what was learned from those lessons, and maybe if anything could be applicable to the United States.
I think that Hayek would be very happy, if it happened in the United States, but that's not seemingly feasible in the coming future. And yes, you're right. The introduction of flat tax was part of the economic reforms in Slovakia at the beginning of 2000s. It showed to be a success story in order to attract new foreign investments. At that time, we lacked the manufacturing base, and if you see it from the perspective of the time when we introduced flat tax, with the current situation, we really became a stronghold in production of cars and electronics. So we possess, with the all European production of cars, we are the largest per capita producer of cars in the world. With the current crisis, we had to modify the flat tax, so both income tax and value added tax have been increased. According to the promises of the current government, we are supposed to start decreasing gradually the value added tax with the public finances going into order. We'll see how the income tax, corporate income tax, will develop, because it's also a political issue. So I wouldn't speculate on that. But flat tax definitely helped at those times.
I just may add that the Czech Republic also introduced flat tax, so we followed pretty much the same route. And just recently, as with Slovakia, a new bracket was introduced as a result of, economic crisis, and some sort of solidarity tax was introduced.
I have one question about the role of capital flows in cross-border capital flows in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. I know generally over the long term, capital mobility is good for growth, but as we've seen in the 2008 crisis, you have capital flight, and that had an effect on the crisis. So do you think maybe working with the EU and in terms of having some kind of capital controls, is that something you guys have been considering? I know that's been a big thing at the EU. A lot of people have been talking about that. So thank you.
Well, first of all, I don't think that we experience any major capital outflow. And in comparison with Southern Europe, Greece, it's never been any significant problem. So I don't think that we ever considered, closing the economy for capital movements or financial transactions or anything like that. And on the contrary, again, we actually sometimes we have seen our koruna, that's our currency, even a little too strong, maybe particularly against the dollar, with some weakening of dollar. We've been actually in a difficult position on American market, because if you take in late 90s, the exchange rate used to be 1 to 40, 42 or something. Now it is 1 to 18. So you see significant strengthening of our currency against the dollar, as which results in difficulties for our exports to the US. And as far as our commitment to adopting the euro, yes, it stands in the books, but it doesn't say when. And I think that it will take some time before the Czech public and the political representation considers that it is the good time to joining the euro.
Yeah, for Slovakia, it's a small economy in Central Europe. The fluctuations of exchange rate used to create actually big problems also when it comes to predictability of investments. So euro membership helps in this situation. As we have a free flow of capital within the European Union, it's really very difficult to make any restrictions on that. And I think it's a quite a natural process, as we had we have had a quite strong influx of investments. We experienced also some outflow of investors further east. These are especially lower paid jobs when the Slovak or Czech economies are becoming less competitive with the productions of those lower paid jobs, they move east. But that happened also in case of Western Europe with car industry and the other segments of economy.
So I'd like to thank both ambassadors for lucid and forthright presentations, and thank the audience for asking really good questions. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a panel discussion with Peter Gondolovich, Czech ambassador to the U.S., and Peter Kmeč, Slovak ambassador to the U.S. Our discussion was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe in association with the Center for Finance, Law, and Policy at Boston University and the Czech and Slovak Association of Boston. Tonight's moderator was Alan Berger, retired editorial writer for international affairs at the Boston Globe. We began with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe director Vivian Schmidt. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.